Welcome. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. And tonight we have another great show dealing with metaphysics and physics and different elements of science in general, as well as other topics as they may be appropriate, and of course, always spirituality. So I would like to tell you that tonight we're going to deal with the physics and metaphysics of out-of-body travel. Now, this is a little bit different than some other shows that we've had about this subject in the past, sometimes on this station and sometimes on other ones. The main point that I want to emphasize tonight is how can this be true? And what is there that we know about in physics and science that makes it true? And then I want to bring in some spiritual ideas that connect with why God, a creator, would want a system that works in this kind of complex way, seemingly, to us at this level of consciousness. And if in fact, the things I'm stating are accurate, then the question becomes, okay, so what is the outcome? How does this all add up? And, you know, there's obviously a purpose with all this stuff going on. So, if you're a new listener, welcome. We're glad to have you on board, and hopefully you'll stay with us for the next 2 hours. And I just want to mention that, in general, I start off with the more difficult concepts because I figure people are still awake at the time, and I haven't buzzed out their brains too far. And so I do want you to realize that I'm not going to be quite at the same levels after the first part of the show. So, you know, if you're lost a little bit, stay on, because we'll get to some points that I'm sure will be more understandable. And some of the things I say now at the beginning may make more sense then, when I come in with more examples and less maybe less concepts than I'm going to state in the next few minutes. Now, I want to start with physics. Now, that's a scary subject. There's going to be no math, and you don't get a test at the end, which is the good news. The not-so-great news is that physics is still a hard subject because it deals with how the very nature of this part of the universe, which we call the physical universe, this part of the universe works. And the thing about physics is that it is not universally applicable to all other parts of the universe. As a matter of fact, quite the opposite. That's why you have to get into metaphysics, which is the physics beyond what has presently been proven or understood to be proven. And so that's where we're going to head to. But we can start off with just what I call somewhat or completely at this point accepted by physicists. Some would say otherwise, but what physics has said for the last century or so, and that's the most important part of the last century. Before that time, most of physics was called classical physics, based upon Isaac Newton's views and then his followers and people that basically followed a very mechanical model of understanding that the universe was made out of things, and those things can certain behaviors based upon laws. And one could always determine the outcome because if you knew, as an example, the speed and trajectory, et cetera, of an object moving through space, you would always be able to tell how and where it would end up without any problems. And there were a lot more assumptions made in Newtonian physics that kind of made everybody feel kind of, we'll say, warm and fuzzy, because after all, we got it all down, and we know how the things work. Well, about the turn of the century, for a few physicists, a little bit before the turn of the 20th century, things started to not sit very well. There was problems in certain types of experiments dealing with how things cooled down and heated up and how pressures developed and didn't develop, and just the normal kinds of experiments that physicists were doing weren't coming out with the right answers. And that's not a good thing, because science is based upon the ability to predict an outcome and have it happen over and over again with different people trying to do the same thing. And unfortunately, for some parts of classical physics, this just wasn't turning out to be true. There was a guy named Maxwell, got very famous with magnetism, but before that, he actually found some problems in physics and of the day. And then several other people who are well-known did. And finally, Albert Einstein decided that he was going to look at the whole nature of a thing called the photoelectric effect and certain other things, which had to do with how an electron hits some piece of metal and bounces another electron off the piece of metal. And everything should work in a certain clockwise way, and there should be no unusual events. And there were very unusual things that started to happen. And this introduced a new kind of physics called quantum physics, in which the old physics of Newtonian physics said that the more you put energy into a system, the more gradually things changed. Well, quantum physics said, no, that isn't how it works. Things jump. There's a sudden and a definite change based upon a specific amount of energy. And there would be no change before, and then an unpredictable, in some circumstances, change afterwards. And this really bothered a number of people. And it produced, eventually, what I call the beginning of metaphysics, because metaphysics really started about the 1920s or so, when people started to, as they used the new physics, quantum mechanics, started to realize that energy doesn't work independent of other energy, and energy doesn't work independent of thought. Now you could say, what? Where did that come from? Well, it actually came from some physicists in the mid-1920s who discovered that under certain very unusual circumstances, energy followed thought. It was somewhat controlled by what people thought, and outcomes in experiments could be affected by how people thought. And this really kind of radicalized the entire concept of a nice, neat, mechanical picture of how the universe worked, where people weren't even counted, to now being the main players. And you even had to consider things like double-blind experiments where human emotion was no longer even an issue. It just involved with trying to figure out how electrons work and stuff. All kinds of issues started to come to the forefront, and metaphysics really began at that point, and so did Gestalt philosophy from certain schools in Germany. And because of the literal existential existence of things beyond what people thought were very logical and very positively defined in the past, now all of a sudden everything was based upon, we'll call it, the probability of events taking place, rather than the event itself. So everything was based upon a probabilistic factor, and the thing that affected probability or could affect probability was thought itself. If you want to read about this, there's a relatively simple book called Mr. Tompkins in Wonderland. Great book. It was written in 1948. That talks about the experiences of Mr. Tompkins, going through a universe in which the quantum constant, the thing that controls these effects that I just described, is suddenly changed. It's increased. And as soon as that happens, all kinds of odd events take place, because Mr. Tompkins' own actions and thoughts behind his actions changed the world around him radically. And it's a good book to read, because some people doubt the things I say about physics because they're not familiar with physics, and they think I'm speaking more about metaphysics when I'm really just talking about physics. Okay, so this change or shift in ideas has not really caught up with people who have not taken much science, and specifically much quantum physics, and especially if they haven't gone beyond quantum mechanics. There's all kinds of other quantum kinds of physics, including field theory. And so as you move further and further away from classical physics, you get more and more into what would be considered metaphysics. Now, what is metaphysics? Metaphysics is just the exploration of the known physics into new ideas, into new realms that have yet to be proven. One of those realms is, some people call it string theory or superstring theory. There's various kinds of string theories. And there are also realms of multidimensionality and asymmetry and these kinds of physics where things could be different in one place than in another. Because one of the assumptions in physics, even quantum physics, was that what happens here happens there. And there is this consistency in the way the universe works. Well, maybe, but maybe not. Especially if there's multidimensionality, that certainly would not be true. Okay, so that kind of, I'm just giving us a little bit of understanding that energy follows thought is not necessarily a metaphysical principle. There's a number of experiments that have suggested or even proven in some circumstances that this is correct. So in other words, the choices we make, and choices are half of thought. Choices with consistency and direction to the choices are actually thought. And if we consistently think something, then it's truly a thought, and that thought can be thought by ourselves and other people and replicated, that thought can actually change the physical world around us. But to a very, 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 very small amount in the world that we exist in, the physical world. Now, there's another part to the physical world. That other part is called the electromagnetic dimensions or subdimensions of the physical world. Electromagnetism is one of the four forces that we're familiar with in terms of physics and in terms of what physicists have decided is all of the ways that energy can be changed. But electromagnetic parts of the dimension also have changes in time-space. And this is another part of physics that's very fascinating. We live in the most curved part of time-space. Now, what does that mean? That means that Albert Einstein, in another part of his experiments, discovered that if you have a lot of energy that is either free-floating around, like electromagnetic energy, or you have a lot of energy that is confined by a form, we'll call that matter, it causes the time-space around it to curve. In all of the universe, and I'm talking about not the universe we're familiar with, but the universe of multidimensional aspects, which I'll cover in a few minutes, but in all of the universe, the physical part where we live is where the universe is most curved. So think of it this way. Because there's such density in energy and therefore matter in the part of the universe we exist in, the space around our part of the universe, we'll call it the lowest dimension of the universe in total, is curved the most and the smallest. Around that curved space, there is another part of the universe. Some people call it the emotional or astral dimensions. There are actually subdimensions of one big astral dimension that is much larger and surrounds the time-space, literally surrounds and it also interpenetrates the time-space that we exist in. So it doesn't just exist outside of us. It also exists inside of us. Let me try to explain that, because that's like a what? You know, it's kind of easier to think of it. Well, it's us as a little, you know, kind of dimension. There's this other dimension around us. and they're really not interacting. But that's not how it works. If it was, it would be easier to think about it, but it'd be unfortunately not very effective for God to do very much with. So instead, the next dimension and all other dimensions that are greater, larger, less curved in space, that means, less dense in energy, that means, those dimensions interpenetrate the dimensions lower than themselves. Now, what does it mean to interpenetrate? Well, it means that the dimension itself exists where we exist, but because it has a greater amount of dimensionality to it, with a much higher frequency, at a different phase or direction that the energy is moving in, and that direction is a direction that doesn't exist in our dimension at all. So dimensionally, it has more dimension to it than where we exist. Now, that's a little hard to understand, but if you think about the bug going around the balloon, and it's a two-dimensional bug, as far as it knows, it can never come back to where it started from, but it keeps ending up coming back because it's going around a balloon, and it's only two-dimensional. And the third dimension is the air inside the balloon. Well, that's kind of what's going on here. We are the bug. And there is another dimension that interpenetrates where we exist, but we're unaware of it because our consciousness is focused very strongly by the density of energy around us on the physical parts of things. And we seldom notice that there's any other dimensional element to our existence. Although human beings do have some sense of this other part of the universe. We call it emotion, the sense of emotion, feeling. Some people prefer that. I like that word. Feeling. We have feelings, and those feelings tell us things about the universe around us. But that feeling part is a new dimension to time and space and exists with what we consider to be the dimensionality of the physical dimension, but without the density of energy that the physical dimension has. So you have the dimensionality in the quote-unquote emotional or astral dimension that is around us and interpenetrates us, but you don't have the dense energy. So the dimension has much vast more space, and it has a large amount more time by the same amount that space is increased. We'll get to the time thing in a little while. It actually has more time than we have. We have very little time here compared to the same, our time compared to their time, they have a lot more time. Well, that sounds funny, but we'll talk about that. All right. And so the dimensionality is the biggest issue here. The dimensionality remains, and it's complete. So there's actually, if you want to talk about, let's say we have three dimensions plus time or some part of time, they would have four dimensions plus time. But we really only have one dimension, but that's another. I don't want to get into that right now. So then they have two, obviously. They have a whole added dimension. And that dimension, unlike our dimension, evolves how energy is moving. The movement of energy, its direction and phase, changes the location of where you are. It's sort of like saying, well, I'm sitting here in front of the soundboard and at the desk, and that's fine and good, but if I were moving in a different direction in terms of how I felt, let's say I felt really, really forlorn and lonely, I'd be in a different place than here, right now. Or if I felt very loving towards a specific thing that I'm not right now thinking about, but let's say I was in my imagination, then I would be someplace other than where I am right now as well. That's a hard thing to understand, isn't it? Because that just doesn't happen in the physical world. No matter how you feel, you stay in the same place, right? But that's not true in the astral world. You feel differently, you are in a different place. And you can be really very far away in some respects from where others are. And they can't see or experience you if you have a different feeling from them. Whoa. That's kind of a new one, isn't it? This is all going to enter into the physics and metaphysics of out-of-body travel. But we have to start with some of the basics here tonight, because if I don't, you're not going to understand why the things that I'm going to talk about happen. But if you understand the physics and metaphysics, then you're going to say, well, oh, that's why he said that earlier, because it explains, blah, blah, blah. So just hang in there with me. I know this stuff sounds like some kind of scary college course or graduate school course on something. It's not that hard. It's just that it's different. It's way different. And if anyone is going to, as I had given brief instructions, try out-of-body travel one time, I don't suggest you do it on a regular basis, just to experience the fact that they are not attached to just their physical existence, which relieves a lot of the fear of death, actually, then this whole evening will be worth then listening to, because you have really a fairly good diagram of what could happen and why is it going to happen, etc. So this is going to be helpful, I hope. And it may answer a number of questions that people have had. I realize the textbook I wrote, Life's Hidden Meaning, has a lot of this stuff in it, but it is lacking the examples because the size of the book was already too big to almost publish. And so when you eliminate those examples, like the ones I'm giving you about all this stuff, it suddenly, you know, it becomes just very difficult to understand. Hopefully this will fill in some of the gaps this evening. And we got the whole 2 hours to do it in, well, whatever's left of those 2 hours. Okay, so this is exciting for me because really this is the way I prefer to teach this stuff. When I would teach study groups about this sort of subject and other things, I would get much deeper than the book would, because I could go into these explanations and people would go, oh, I finally understand what you're talking about. it's gratifying to know that sometimes it comes through, you know. And if you're a new listener tonight, you probably said, where did this guy come from? Well, don't worry. I'll explain more about that, too. Because when we get into out-of-body travel, sometimes people ask, well, how do you know this stuff? Well, I'll explain that. So don't worry. You'll get some... We get some understanding of that as well. So let's continue on. So the neat thing is that there's this interpenetration, but we barely notice it. We do have feelings. That's good. The feelings tell us something about the other dimension that we are not too aware of. But our consciousness is focused on our physical form and on physical things around us. So we're very, very much, our senses, though, this is all that exists, is this part of the universe. The physical part. But there is this electromagnetic part. The electromagnetic part, we don't have a lot of sense of. Some people have more sense of it than others. It's difficult to have much sense of it because we aren't equipped, like some creatures are, to really notice it. We were given only a certain limited amount of sense. Interestingly, very early ancestors of us in prehistoric times had much more sense, and a few peoples today do, such as the Aborigines in Australia, the ones, if they still are any, who live more of a traditional life. Those people, when they go on a walkabout, which is really, they leave their physical body and they etherically or electromagnetically travel in their etheric or electromagnetic body to various places. They literally fly at 100 or more miles an hour, and they can travel great distances, relatively great distances, and see things and experience the world from flight over great distances and know where they're heading to. That's a great if you're living in a kind of jungle environment, or if you're living in a desert but it's rugged and difficult to traverse. It tells you a lot about where you are going, etc. And it also allows them to sometimes have better communication with plants and animals, because sometimes some of those life forms actually have better sense than some humans do. They have what our overall distant ancestors had as a sense that we have mostly lost. Some of them still have it, and certainly dozens, if not 100 years ago, many of them had it. As they get westernized, the sense diminishes rapidly because there's so much focus on the physical world, and they leave that other side alone. Some people call it the third eye effect. It's sort of connected to the Ajna center, the brow chakra, and some people have a greater sense of etheric sight at that part, in their part, that part of their etheric body. All right, so if we look at what this means, in the electromagnetic part of us, if our consciousness focuses mostly in that body, we still might have feelings from the astral world, very subtle, and some mental sense, so subtle that most people have no idea what I just said, and the physical sense goes away. And as soon as that happens, you're freed in what is some people call the etheric double, or the part of us that kind of looks much like our physical body, but it's made out of purely electromagnetic energy. It's a part that we first end up in, sometimes only for seconds or minutes, sometimes for hours or days after we die. But it's also the part that we go into when we fall asleep for a matter of seconds before we usually leave the physical world. This is not true of young children. Sometimes they stay in their etheric bodies for a half hour, an hour. They could float around the whole neighborhood, you know, and visit things. They actually have those experiences, usually before about age 5, and then they stop having it. That's due to a lack of integration of the personality, and they don't go dreaming it into the astral world very quickly. So they, instead of for a few seconds to a minute or two, they could be out for a long time and have experiences and remember them. And you'll even, if you talk to some young children, they'll talk about, oh, I slept last night, and when I went to sleep, I left the house, and I went over the roofs of all the houses nearby, and, you know, I noticed the chimney on the other side of the neighborhood has got some things falling off of it, and I went past a bird nest, and, yeah, talk to kids and listen. Okay, so, and maybe you will remember some experiences from your own childhood or from the children you have. They'll tell you. It's amazing. Okay, so let's continue. These are out-of-body experiences, but they're still in the physical world, but the electromagnetic part. Now, what happens when you're in this part of your body? Well, first of all, it weighs next to nothing. I mean, there is a weight, technically, to the electromagnetic energy in TV waves and radio and, you know, x-rays and you name it. There's all kinds of different electromagnetic bands of energy. And the etheric body, it contains all of these, but at an angle or a phase that's somewhat different from the non-living energies, which separates it from them. And this is the part that some people say when they see an aura, they're seeing this electromagnetic part of the body. Some types of accurate, but there's very inaccurate types, of Carillion photography sometimes do reveal this. Other types are actually picking up artifacts that are not real. But there are some photographs that are actually accurate if you do it right. But at any rate, so this body weighs nothing or next to nothing. And because it has such a low density, it has almost no mass to it, the thought of the person is still the same. Actually, it's a little stronger. When your consciousness is focused in your etheric body, it's about a third stronger. You can think about a third better than you can while you're physically focused. So you have stronger consciousness, stronger thought, with virtually no mass. Well, that combination causes what is known as a change in the relationship between energy and thought, and there's a thing called the quantum constant, which kind of measures that. It's actually a measure of something different from that, but it really is a measure of that because it's all interrelated. And that grows. Quantum constant grows in the etheric part of the physical world to as much as over twice. It doesn't sound like much, but it's enough by far with the amount of thought that a person usually has to be able to move around and float, literally, up to thousands of feet above the ground at well over 100 miles an hour, although most people don't necessarily travel at that fast. And as long as there's not a barrier like a Faraday cage, which is like a bunch of cross-hatched wires in the walls around you, you can literally float right through the walls because, oh, we have somebody calling in right now. Hello, caller.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm calling in. I have a very unusual question. I've been on the spiritual path and the path of ascension and reading and researching and really studying everything. And my question is, sometimes I get very frustrated and I'm discovering that I'm empathic and that I seem to take on people's feelings and almost have psychic abilities, but this particular moment, I feel that there's something trying to be communicated to me from by spirit, but I don't know what it exactly is, and it's like an instinct of I need to go somewhere in particular, but I don't know where exactly. Can you explain?
Well, I wish that I could explain. What you're telling me is that you're having some type of psychic phenomena, but unfortunately, I'm not inside of you, so I can't really tell you that much about it. I can tell you this, though, that if you want to understand more about this, you could possibly continue listening to the show. Have you heard the show before?
I have never heard the show, but I did agree with a lot of the things that you were saying in spirit.
I see.
While I was
well, I'll tell you what, because this show is right now, at least, so maybe if you continue listening, maybe some of your questions will be answered through. I'll try to weave them in to other things I'm going to talk about. But I don't want to take us too far off the subject. And the other thing you can do, you can contact me at thoughts@whylifeis.com or niles@whylifeis.com. And email me, and we can have a conversation, so to speak, that way. You can even call me. But the important thing is that I don't want to go too far astray from what we're talking about right now. And your question is very, very specific about yourself, and I would like to deal with that probably off the air. How's that sound?
Okay, thank you so much.
Sure.
I'm listening.
Okay, good. Keep listening. Okay, let's continue on. And that's true for other callers, too. If you have a personal question, it's okay to bring it up during the show itself. And what I'll do is I'll try to maybe bring up some things that will be helpful to even answer the question in general. But you also can contact me, and I'm even available by phone, although usually you have to arrange a time to do that. And We'll talk about it off the air, as well as me bringing up what I can connected to it on the air. And we'll talk about having psychic experiences and some of that in relationship to today's show. I'll bring it in after the break for sure. Okay, so let me continue on. So here's our situation. We have an etheric body that has almost no mass, but an accentuated thought, which means that you can direct it and go through even walls and doors and windows without much trouble. It feels a little funny if you do it. I mean, it isn't like you don't feel something. You do sense something. It's more of an electrical tingle. but you do feel something. But nonetheless, you can do it. And of course, the first time it may be a little disconcerting to think, well, I think I'll just fly through that wall or through the roof and see how that is. But for a lot of people, that may be a bit much. And most people actually, if they have an out-of-body experience that's etheric, which is typically the first kind of experience people have, they don't leave the room, literally, because they're worried, like, oh, there's my body. I can see my physical body, but I'm someplace else floating around up here. I don't know if I want to go too far, because what happens if I can't get back, you know? So there's that thought that usually enters into the picture. And if it's too strong of a thought, you'll be just right back into your physical body within a split second or so. And, that's okay, too. You might be a little disheveled from that experience, but you can still go on and get over the feelings you might have about that sudden fear you might have experienced, like, gee, am I going to be able to get back? And the answer is always, yes, you can get back. Well, always provided the physical body is not harmed. I mean, if you kill or destroy part of the physical body, that could be a problem, but that's another thing. Then you could be just physically dead, but still etherically alive. And a lot of people are in that position for even weeks after their death. But that's more because they're choosing than because they can't go on and go elsewhere. We'll talk about going elsewhere. So we have now the basis of where I wanted to get to, which is great, by this time, because we're almost coming up on the break right now. But I want to just let you realize that what I'm talking about is complicated, but I hope I made it simple enough so that we have a basis for starting at least this understanding of what out-of-body travel is like and how it is that somebody can be out of your body and travel through literally flying through the air in the etheric part of, or electromagnetic, same thing, part of the physical world. Other people won't necessarily see you unless they have etheric sight. So if you go visit some traditional Aborigines, maybe they'll see you. And you can say hello, and they'll say hello back. But most of the time, people don't see you, just as we don't see radio and television waves. They're going on all over us, and cell phones, and you name it. Just nowadays, they're everywhere. Now, interestingly, those waves do not interfere with our movement either, because they are in a phase with kind of a direction of the energy that moves differently than living energy does, living etheric energy. So if you're alive and in etheric form, you're not necessarily harmed, which is a good thing that you aren't, by the electromagnetic energy around you. It can be somewhat stressful, and sometimes you can be blocked, like I said, by a Faraday cage, which is a bunch of wire at different angles, or some other kinds of high intensity electromagnetic energy can have an effect on people in etheric form, and vice versa as well. Okay, so what we're going to do now, we're going to go to a break, and we'll be going about 2.5 minutes. And when we come back, I'll get into some other parts. This is going to get more and more out there, as they say, as the show continues on. And we'll be back in about 2.5 minutes from right now.
Hun, what book are you reading?
It's a novel, kind of, about romance, love, and spiritual life in general.
Kind of a novel? What do you mean?
Well, it's based on some real-life experiences and even real characters. Some of their experiences are fascinating and remarkable. I can't put this book down.
How come the title is Afterlife Love?
That's part of the fascination. This book describes the afterlife in intricate detail and even explains why things are the way they're explained.
But how can anyone write about or know that?
Some of the characters travel out of body to some places that people who've already died also go to. I'm finding it completely believable because it all makes sense and fits into a bigger picture for me.
Hun, what happens to these people?
You can read it for yourself when I'm done if you want.
Better yet, I'll get my own copy so we can discuss it while we read. Let me see. I'll write down the title. It's Afterlife Love by Niles McFlower, MacFlouer.
Afterlife Love is available in some bookstores and from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com or 480-966-3132. That's 480-966-3132.
Hi, everyone. Since childhood, I've had questions about my life and life in general that I couldn't find adequate answers to. Questions like, why am I here? Why are others here? Does the universe have a purpose? And how does that relate to my life? More recently, I've been wondering what happens when we die, especially the reasons why. I'm more of a doubter than a believer in many things, and answers that include the whys allow me to think and figure out the truth for myself. I've been reading a book, Life's Hidden Meaning. This one book contains more answers, including the whys, than all other sources I've read or heard. It's amazing to me that every one of my questions has been thoroughly answered. More importantly, I have found that all of these answers so far have checked out to be true. I hope this message helps some of you in your quest for better understanding. The name of this wonderful book is, again, Life's Hidden Meaning by metaphysician Niles McFlower. Some bookstores sell it. I got my copy directly from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com. Life's Hidden Meaning may enlighten your mind and bring some peace and joy to your heart.
We're back. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. Tonight we're talking about the physics and metaphysics of out-of-body travel. But to really get what that means, we spent the first section of the show dealing with some of the physics about it. Now we're going to get into even more metaphysics, which is going to probably sound like science fiction, but it's, of course, not, in my opinion, and also experience. So let's talk about my experience. I think that this is the appropriate time to just relate very briefly, how is it I know this stuff? I mean, yeah, you can read about some of it, but most of what I tell you is stuff you can't read anyplace unless you read my stuff. So, you know, it's you can read parts of it from people's own out-of-body experiences, from having revelations and various kinds of other things happen to them. But let me say this. A long time ago, actually, for some people anyway, back in the 1970s, I was director of a mental health institute, where it was kind of on the far edge of things. We did experiments, some of it in the field of noetics, not just in psychology. Noetics is the field of consciousness. And within that field, one of the questions was, can consciousness exist outside of the physical body? Or is it some way part of the brain or part of some physical connection that cannot be removed? And that was the question. That was the question that was posed in a research project. And using an isolation tank, a sensory isolation tank, and a sensory isolation room, people were given the opportunity to deprive themselves of all input from the existing physical world, hoping they would have out-of-body experience. And most did. As a matter of fact, almost all did. The ones that didn't go running out crazy, you know. And we tested people, made sure nobody would, or very few people would have that kind of negative experience. At the time, I didn't really think that the experiment was going to prove much, because I wasn't the head person involved in the experiment. I was director of the institute, but it was somebody else's research project. And eventually, they proved to me that there was, in fact, consciousness of people existing, leaving their physical bodies and existing in other dimensions, from the etheric one I just mentioned to the different parts of the astral dimension. And this so convinced me, without going into how and why, that I eventually decided, well, you know, I got to try this out myself. And since it was kind of like I had control over the keys, I went ahead and did a lot more experimentation than many other people had the chance to while we had this experiment going, which lasted a couple of years. And during that time, I did my own, we'll say, experiments in other dimensions of time and space. I scientifically, as best as I could, try to determine how and why things were happening the way they were. And I tested basic notions of physics, because luckily I had a background in physics besides psychology. This was a good combination for the kind of work that I was doing. And the kind of research that I did myself, besides the experimental aspects of the project itself. So from that, I was able to then read everything I could on the subject, add a great deal to it, and talk tonight with some authority about what it means to have out-of-body travel and what other dimensions of time and space are like, etc. That was a long time ago now. So since that time, obviously, I've had many other kinds of experiences. The tank is no longer a necessary issue. And I don't do much out-of-body traveling as I did then, because then it was for the purpose of knowledge and better understanding. And once I achieve that, I'm more concerned about conveying it to others than I am about just having a fun time in the astral world or something like that, which is not usually the case, by the way, for most people. Okay, so let's get back to the subject at hand. Out-of-body travel is controlled by our own thoughts. As long as we are thinking using the physical, the dense physical senses of our body, we can't leave our body. We literally cannot. The only way we can leave our body is to shift our focus of attention and awareness, and then our consciousness about that awareness, to another set of senses. You can start with the etheric or electromagnetic senses, which is part of the physical body, but it's the electromagnetic part. If you focus your senses onto those centers, or chakras, some people call them, and the senses connected to them, then your consciousness moves into that body, because those are the senses that you're using. But you have to, at the same time, block out all of the sense coming through your physical senses. That's why being in a sensory isolation tank makes it really easy. But if you don't have one of those, and that too many people do, and I'm not talking about the ones that just have salt water and you just go lay in them. The tank we had true zero gravity experience and a lot of other things that gave the sensation of truly no input. The sense of gravity is so strong on us that even if you lay on a very soft, nice, cushy bed, you still have a sense of gravity unless you can focus your attention away from it. And if you can do this by blocking out your thought about all sense coming in, the senses may still be picking up some things, but you're not focusing your consciousness and your thought on them. And you focus your consciousness and thought on your etheric body, which is kind of like a different wave sensation, which I described in a prior show. Then you can move your consciousness from the physical body into the etheric very easily, actually, because once you block out the physical, it naturally, your consciousness wants to naturally experience something, so it moves to the next body that senses are available in, and that would be the etheric. When you're in that body, as soon as you're in it, you're outside of your physical body. And because your thought is so strong in comparison to the amount of density and energy, you immediately repel yourself from your physical body. It's kind of an automatic event, and part of that automatic event happens in two different ways. First, if you died, it happens because your physical body is no longer you, and you're repelled by it. But if your physical body is still alive, and you're just doing out-of-body travel, the reason you move away from the physical body is because of a sense of freedom. There's this desire on the part of most people to experience greater and greater amounts of freedom, freedom of movement, freedom of energy, freedom of thought, and this comes from moving away from the physical body. That's why most people don't stay very close to their physical body. Once they go into their etheric, they actually float to the or near the top of the room and look down, even though the etheric body isn't that far from the physical body in the normal circumstances. So you could be separated from the physical body by this etheric double. Is there still an electromagnetic part of the physical body that exists around it while the physical body lays there? Yes, there is, but it's weakened. Just as the etheric body that you're in, that you're floating around in, is also weakened. So this is important to understand. Both parts of the etheric body are being split. And the double, as it's called, that you're floating around in, is maybe half as strong as the whole etheric body. And that can have a negative effect on your senses because you're separating the senses when you do this. I hope you understand what I'm saying. And so when you come back into the etheric body, the whole sense array of the etheric body can be a little disheveled and not quite work properly because you split it for a while you're out. A good reason not to do this very often, because you may actually have a negative effect on your sense while you're doing it, if you follow what I'm saying. I mean, it's not terrible. And certainly if you did it for 5 or 10 minutes, it's not going to be a horrible event. But if you did it for hours on end every day, it could affect your overall centers, your etheric centers, and it may make you weak, more susceptible to disease, and less able to sense things in general. So this is important. Each one of the 7 major chakras corresponds to one of the 5 senses and 2 senses, 5 senses of form, and the 2 senses of God or of our Creator. That's a total of 7 senses. And so the major chakras, each one is focused on one of the major senses. Wow. Human beings have 2 senses of spiritual content. They don't sense any physical thing. They sense whether God is or is not part of something around us and to what extent God is there. It gives us a sense of beauty. It gives us a sense of being spiritual. It gives us a sense of being part of the whole, the greater. So by nature, humans are spiritual beings, whereas animals don't have that sense unless they are very close to people and they can gain a small amount of it. But under general circumstances, naturally in the wild, animals just don't have a spiritual sense. So they're not spiritual beings on their own in general. But if they're connected with people and the people are good people, then that could happen to some extent. All right. Getting back into this question then of out-of-body travel. Out-of-body travel has some hidden dangers, but it also has a very big plus. You get out of your physical body, and the first thing you realize is, hey, when I'm dead, I'll be able to look at my body, and I'll be floating around up here, and nothing's going to bother me. And you don't feel the pain of the physical body any longer. There are some etheric things that might cause you to feel some pain, like very sudden bursts of electromagnetic energy. But outside of that, pretty much, the whole death experience is no big deal. Because most people, when they're dying, are losing contact with their physical body before they actually die. And a lot of them never experience their own physical death. Either it happens too suddenly, or if it's slowly, they're watching it happen from a place where people don't know whether they are, but they're usually in a corner of the room, towards the ceiling, watching it all go on, and not really experiencing any kind of unpleasantness. Even though their body may be reacting, choking, whatever, they don't experience that. They say, oh, that's too bad. I guess the body's dying, you know. I mean, but it's kind of a dispassionate place to be. Now, they could have obviously feelings of leaving the world, leaving the physical world, and they know almost immediately nobody can see them, so that kind of isolates them. They could meet somebody else who's in etheric form, and they could have communication with them. But for the most part, people aren't going to be able to see them. Now, you could call them ghosts, but they're really not. A ghost is someone who spends too much time in the etheric world with only half of their etheric sense. Remember, the other half kind of dissipates with the physical body when it dies. So that part that you're in is not going to be all that stable, and it starts to disintegrate pretty rapidly. And because it isn't connected to the whole body any longer, within weeks to a few months, you lose your senses. And as you lose your senses, you kind of like become an etheric Alzheimer case, and the next thing you know, you're a ghost. Ghosts are really not all there, as they say. There aren't too many of them. Only a few thousand, usually, at a time are running around. But they can do things, and sometimes they haunt places because they don't know any better. They don't know where to go, and they can't get away from where they're at because their attention is overly focused on a brief piece of what they remember of their past life. And they may be obsessive about their focus of attention, and they can't move beyond whatever their thought is. It's their thought that causes movement, and if their thought is all focused to be in one or two or three places, that's the only places they can go. All right, enough for ghosts. That could be another whole show, obviously, and I've done a few of those. But let's talk more about this physics issue now. So you can be any place that you can block the lower senses from, and as long as you have the higher senses working, okay, you can be in that part of the universe. But I'm going to talk a lot more about how to get to some of the other parts in a couple of minutes, but I just want you to realize that in terms of physics right now, based upon how I explained the metaphysics of the focus of senses, focus on different senses in different bodies, and your attention being away from the lower parts of the universe, you naturally move into a different dimensionality. The etheric is easiest to understand because it's still part of the physical world. And there's no big kind of change in the physics. I mean, it's a little different. There is a quantum constant change. But for all intents and purposes, things seem pretty much the way they were while you were in your physical body. There is some differences, though. Sound. It's hard to hear speech unless you've done it more than once or you spent more than a half hour to an hour in your etheric body. Because the speech you're hearing is moving at a slower rate. It's like a phonograph record or a tape. Can't talk about a DVD anymore or a CD because you can't do that with them, but just slow them down, you know? You know what I'm talking about. And you start talking like this. And the tone of the voice gets lower, and it also sounds very electric. It has a fuzzy electricness to it. So that's what you're hearing. People are seemingly also moving, and they actually are, moving slower than you are. So it's like everybody slowed down for some reason. And you can't necessarily figure that one out because you didn't do anything different. You're just floating around watching them. But people seem to be moving slowly, and they seem to be talking slowly and fuzzy. And there's a change in a shift of color, and you notice this that the people take on a different hue of color. And so the whole thing is a little strange. It's still visible and still somewhat understandable. You can still listen to some extent what people are saying, and after a little practice and some patience, you can listen to what people are saying. It's easiest if you're in the fourth subplane, the lowest one of the electromagnetic or etheric subplanes. If you're there, that's where you can get the most amount of information, and usually you can pick up sounds. If you move your consciousness to a higher subplane, you may or may not be able to even see people, your movement, and you certainly are going to have a much harder time being able to make any sense out of what they may be saying. They can't see you at all. You're just not in their vision, unless they're very young children. Young children can, and so can people who are psychic. for our last caller. I'm just going to add a little bit about that. We pick up things, some people pick up things, because some of their senses are not fully integrated, either because when they were children they didn't become integrated, or because of a prior life experience they have some issues from, sort of like spiritual genes aren't working right, or they're working in some different way. Or sometimes if you do a lot of out-of-body travel, especially as an adult, you can start having we'll call it lower psychic experiences. There are many other things that can cause lower psychic experiences. Just being around explosions, like in a battlefield. Sometimes being around very powerful electromagnetic fields can have some effect on some people. And sometimes just having very strange emotional experiences in your life daily that come out as you are going to sleep can have a, we'll say, a relatively rough and unquieting experience while a person is falling asleep, while they're coming back from sleep, and also sporadically if they get tired during the day. They may have a sudden little something pop in that is unusual from them. Again, this has to do with the senses being a little off, oddly. I know there's a lot of people who are psychics, think that it's very special to have it, et cetera. And it might be. It has, you know, it has some interesting factors. But having psychic experiences is usually related to some other issues in the person's life and not because, well, you know, I'm just on the path of my having psychic experiences. Psychic experiences are not necessarily meaning that you're doing anything good or bad in terms of your spiritual life. Oh, we got somebody calling in again. Hello, caller.
Hi, Niles. It's Monica. How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
Great. Listen, I was wondering, could another person be spirit plane nearby, someone who's traveling, and communicate with them one-to-one and kind of help them to overcome their fears of being in that dimension? Is that possible?
It's very difficult for us to sense people etherically. If you haven't already been doing a lot of etheric out-of-body travel, your etheric senses are not going to usually be strong enough to be able to detect people who are around you in etheric form. So it's kind of like it's a chicken and egg problem, that people who might be helped to have some experience with someone who is in an etheric body and say, hey, I'm over here, that means that you don't have to worry about dying. Unfortunately, those people have the ones that have the most fear about dying have the least chance of actually experiencing someone in etheric form, or someone who's already had the experience and doesn't have the fear anymore might have the kind of etheric sense that they can actually detect those etheric things around them. Also, the more you serve in various ways in your physical life and then in your sleeping life, the more there's a possibility that you will have etheric sense develop and you'll have be able to sense certain etheric things going on around you. I hope I answered your question. I don't know if I did. Did I do that?
Yeah, it was very interesting. I was just wondering, like when you're on the astral plane, you can be in the same place but two completely different places at the same time. So I wondered if the physics was kind of like that on the etheric plane. So really it's based more on one's capacity to sense the effect on the astral plane.
We're not in the astral world yet. As a matter of fact, I'm going to take another brief break, and then we're going off to the astral world. So then things really are going to get strange. Because then, yes, you can
be... Thank you very much.
Okay, you take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, so let me give you all a breather after that caller. And let me just mention, yes, we're almost there. We're almost there. We've got Phi Chi Jiza come the way. I think we'll have some by the end of next week or the beginning of the week following. They'll be bottling it by the end of next week, I think, or the beginning of the following week. And I can say that we really Everyone's excited about it because we've tested some of the last final batches, and the stuff works great, better than much earlier research stuff did, because we didn't have all the ingredients at the time when we were doing our research. But now it's all come together, and I'm expecting that within 1 week to a week and a half, we will have oodles of bottles filled with Phytogesic tablets. And this stuff is great. I mean, it really works. It does everything that we've said, and it really gets rid of most pains. It does a lot of other things besides that. And it's all natural. There is nothing in it that's not natural. It's a natural product completely. And that's neat. No drugs, no addictions, no major kind of bad side effects. And you can take it as little or as much as you want up to a certain point. I mean, I wouldn't take an entire bottle filled. Probably get a stomach ache or something for that. But the point is that within the label limits and somewhat even beyond, you can take as few as two or three of these tablets every 8 hours, or you can take as much as, well, at least one time, 10, but usually no more than 8. And the more you take, the more it gets rid of a stronger kind of pain. And it deals with most of the pains that adults have. It isn't aimed for children and some of the complaints of children. And so I'm not recommending it be used for children at this time. But it is, for most of the pains that adults have, it is great. And it can be used in so many different circumstances. And depending upon how much you take, you can titrate is the name they use. The dosage to any level you want. And that's really cool. Now, we're supposed to say serving size, but I can call it a dose. But you can make it whatever you want. And it's an herbal supplement, so you don't have to get a script. It's not even an OTC drug. And it's good for you. It does a lot of great things. It works on the electromagnetic part of us, the etheric body, which is what we've been talking about. It works along the meridians of the part of a nadir system, similar to the physical nervous system, but it's an electromagnetic form, and it connects a lot of minor centers, hundreds of them, to one of the major chakras. Each center is connected to one of the major chakras, and in many cases clustered with some other minor centers. It does an amazing job. It covers a full array, and we tried to keep the number of ingredients down, which is not so low, but it's 63. And if we wanted to cover more types of pain more effectively, we'd have to double or triple the number of ingredients, and that would make it unaffordable and probably unusable. So we kind of made some decisions about what the maximum number of ingredients and size of tablet and cost, et cetera, would be. And we went after the major things that most people complain about, everything from joints and certain types of arthritis kind of things and headaches, a big issue. So that was kind of a major player in our pains. And attention. That is associated with pain. Some of the earlier research parts of the Fai Chi could not deal with that because we didn't have the right herbs yet delivered to us. But we got everything, now it does. So you take it, it completely relaxes, or mostly relaxes. You don't get too relaxed because then you have a side effect. But so you have to kind of find the happy medium. But pain causes tension. And tension in itself can be a new kind of pain. I'm sure all of us know that. And the Phytogesic not only gets rid of the pain, which is wonderful, but the associated tension from having had the pain for some period of time before you took the Gesic is also dealt with fairly effectively. We don't try to get 100% of the tension away in all circumstances because it might make you too sedated. So you have to find some level, and that's up to us, choose, where we think we've got it where most people are going to like it. I'm going to say, yeah, feel relaxed enough, but I'm not looped, you know. And so hopefully that will be okay for most. And the interesting thing is you can change it. I mean, if you feel you're getting looped a little bit, you can take a little less, and you still might deal with most of the pain, and you're not so looped. Or vice versa, let's say you got rid of most of the pain, but you still want to relax a little bit more, you can take a little bit more, and it won't hurt you. There's no addiction. There's no major complications or side effects by taking more. This is a great, great product, great analgesic. And I hope that you're going to consider trying it out. We have trial sizes. They're like $20. And and you can't lose the $20, because if you buy the trial size and it doesn't work for you, you just say, hey, this didn't work, and we'll give you your money back. Yeah. And the same is true even of the larger size. One time, if you buy one of those and it doesn't work, we'll give you money back for that too. But what we're trying to say is we really believe in this product. We think for 99% of the people it's going to work. The 1% of the people it won't work for or less. You can't hit everything on everybody all the time. People have very unique systems, some do. And we can only hope to be able to treat and help the vast majority of people. Anyway, so it's coming. It's coming. Okay, back to this topic. Okay, so we kind of left off with the etheric body. And what happens now if instead of focusing on your etheric body, you focus on your feelings? Whoa, that's a totally different thing. If you can focus on your feelings while the etheric wave is going up and down you, as I described, instead of focusing on the etheric wave, you focus on the feeling as the etheric wave is moving up and down. You can move out of your physical body into your astral body. Now, for a brief second, you do go through the etheric subplanes, and you actually have a fractional second where you're in the etheric body. But if you stay more than a fraction of a second in your etheric body, you won't be able to get into your astral body. You'll stay in the etheric body and you'll just be locked in the etheric world. So you have to really stay with the feeling while you're going through the etheric body. Very difficult to do. And you want to try to stay in a sense of feeling that is very focused out, meaning not self-focused, not wanting to feel something for your own benefit, and very giving or loving towards others. The feeling of wanting to give to others is important to have, or you end up in the lower astral subplanes. Now, what's wrong with that problem, that situation? Well, it's this. The lower astral subplanes are where people go who have lived their lives in selfish ways fairly consistently. Some of them were very selfish, and then you go to the lower astral subplanes. And you don't want to end up there, because if you do end up there, there's not much good that's going to happen from it. And you could have a lot of negative things. If you want to read about these things, you can get Life's Hidden Meaning, or the novel I wrote, Afterlife Love, which is really not much of a novel, because it's based upon real experiences. All of the experiences in the astral world actually happened to someone at some point, so they're real experiences. And so you're going to have a good understanding of what I'm saying if you read that. Now, if you don't want to read that, I'll go into some brief thoughts about it. But if you have any intention of doing astral traveling, which, by the way, I don't necessarily think everybody should be doing, because, again, the split senses, the change in focus of consciousness causes damage to some of your astral senses, and you might not be as empathic when you come back. You might not feel as strongly as you could in some ways, or you might be exaggerated in some feelings in other ways. These are all kinds of things that I don't think are really all that beneficial, but again, I'm here as a teacher, not your parents or parent. So I'm just giving out information. I guess it'd be flyer beware. So here's the point. If you're going to be astral traveling, you're going to be focused in your astral body. And your focus has to remain there for as much as anywhere from, oh, if you're going to the highest astral sub-worlds, it's easiest to get there, in a sense, by time. So you'll get there fairly quickly. But if you're going to the lower astral sub-worlds, it could be 30 seconds before you arrive. Now, what does that mean? That means you have to keep yourself focused on whatever feelings that you're focused on. Hopefully they're going to be loving ones. But if they're selfish feelings, you might still end up in the astral world. You have to be focused on those feelings for maybe 30 seconds. And during that time, if you can keep yourself together, you'll notice you're going through a tunnel, a kind of odd-shaped tunnel. Now, the reason it's odd-shaped is because you're moving into a new dimension of time and space. Yeah, it's the Twilight Zone. And this new dimension adds directionality to the energy. And the body that you're moving in responds to directionality in your from the energy in your feelings. So whatever you're picturing in your mind and whatever feeling is associated with that is directing where you're going to end up, even what you're going to be wearing when you get there. You could be wearing anything from nothing. If you like being naked, that's cool. To any elaborate costume or whatever related to both your feelings and your thoughts, thoughts being astral thoughts, which is creative imagination. It's not like thinking in mental terms. And that's going to control what's going to happen to you. And if you go halfway through this tunnel, call it the tunnel of light, and you're going to notice that your direction through the tunnel is not straight, but moving in an angle, which is weird. And as you move in an angle, the tunnel seems to move with you. Okay? That you notice is you're definitely moving in an angle and that you're kind of, you're not moving straight. Now, that's a little hard to understand. And the results of this could be that if you don't maintain focus in your consciousness, in the astral body, you'll spring back into the etheric or back to the physical. That either one could possibly happen. Most of the time you go right back to the physical. And also, when you spring back, it's not real pleasant. It's like a sudden shock. So it feels like, oh, something bad happened. Nothing bad really happened, but you feel that way. You feel out of sorts. It may be also that you don't have much astral feeling, emotional feeling, when you get back. If you spring back like that. If you could stay focused, and if you're in the tunnel for a pretty long period of time, like 15 to 30 seconds, you're headed for one of the lower astral subworlds. That's the first thing you should be aware of. And when you get there, whatever you're self-focused on, selfishly focused on, whatever emotionality you have rather than love, is going to be played out in some way. Possibly with people who live in that part of the world, and certainly with the things, objects, entities, beings, animals, or imagery. So be aware that it is not going to necessarily be just fun and games, and whatever you experience is going to be a result of your own desires and your own creative imagination. If you go there with anger, you're going to experience a lot of anger may be coming towards you. If you go there with sexual thoughts, certainly going to experience those. And the same is true of whatever feelings you might have, if they're self-focused. If you want to have a good time and fun, well, you're going to have probably what you think to be a good time and fun until it starts being a good time. But at least in the beginning, you're going to believe it's probably a good time and fun. It may not turn out to be that way. Going into the astral world is one of the most diverse kinds of potential experiences a person can have because it's really dependent upon their own thinking, because the astral body is thousands of times less dense than the etheric body. Remember how low density that was? You can fly around the room and here and there. Well, on the astral body, you can literally move hundreds of thousands of miles in a few seconds. That's hard to understand. That could be faster than the speed of light is in the physical world. And how do you do that? Well, you can, this energy is following thought. If you can, in your creative imagination, create yourself into another place that you know about, because you have to have been to the astral world to know about it, you can literally place yourself in that place and instantly appear there. If you think about a place that you haven't been to, but something that may actually exist in the astral world, you can be there in a second or two. And if you think about it strong enough, even if it doesn't exist in the astral world, you could create it in a matter of a few seconds to a couple of minutes by thinking about it, and then you'll be there. That's how weird the astral world is. You can go to a place that doesn't even exist until you get there, having created it from your own creative imagination. Wow. Now, some other things about the astral world. The astral world has multidimensionality because, dependent upon how you feel, you could be in the same three-dimensional physical location as somebody else, but because your feelings are totally different, you're actually in a different place. And so it's a huge, huge place because it has this other dimension to it. And that changes everything, doesn't it? Now, the astral world has seven sub-dimensions to it. Actually, there's an eighth that's been created by evil. Evil has slowed down the frequency and changed the phase of energy in their bodies and in the world around them to about half of the seventh or lowest dimension of energy in the astral world. And so evil exists in its own sphere. It's literally called the eighth sphere. And it's dark. And we can't see it unless we put ourselves there ourselves. You can't see it from any perspective unless for some reason you are very enlightened and you are in some need of service that has to do with that dimension. Then you can see into it. Those are rare, rare exceptions. For the rest of everyone, it's invisible, but it's there. About half the density, half the speed of the lowest other energy in the astral world is this A sphere. So it's pretty divided. Very divided, actually. It's still many times less dense than the energy is even in the etheric part of our dimension. So those beings are not in our world, and they aren't really fully in the astral world. They're in their own little created section. Even the light from the astral world cannot reach into the eighth sphere. So you can't see, you can't sense what's going on there. They don't work on light. They work on darkness. That doesn't mean you can't see anything if you were in the eighth sphere. You can see through the darkness of the eighth sphere. But then you better protect yourself, because that darkness will totally corrupt any feelings of love or other feelings of positive nature you might have. Okay, enough of that. I don't think anybody's going to the astral world to visit the eighth sphere. Again, once we embark through the tunnel of light, as it's called, the nature of what our desires are cause us to leave that tunnel and enter the subdimension that is connected to our creative imagination and our desires. When you enter in a flash of light, literally, and you're usually not at ground level, although some people aren't. The possibilities are fairly vast, Most people usually find themselves 20, 30 feet above what appears to be the ground, and then they just float to the ground. Some people appear just sitting on the ground or laying on the ground. Some people may appear in a tree or on top of a rock or a building. Yes, there are cities and buildings that are in the astral world because collections of people who live there, these are people who have died from the physical world, have decided to stay together because of common desires, common imaginations, and they build with their thought whole cities. It's easy to do because whatever you creatively imagine within seconds to minutes will be created before you. The only thing that you're limited by is your senses, the amount of your creative imagination, which is a type of energy, and how much time you have. That's the only thing that limits you into what you can create in the astral world. You don't have to go out and build a house or dig any ditches or do anything. That's what we call physical labor because it's a non-physical place. It exists because of the desires of its inhabitants. Once you're there, you can fly. If your senses are good enough to do so and your imagination is strong enough, you can fly at great speeds or you can instantly reappear someplace, as I explained. The ability to move around the astral world is far greater than even the etheric part of the physical world. Outer-body travel there, therefore, is more dramatic. The physics have changed because the quantum constant is now not two times greater, but hundreds to thousands of times greater. And you have to multiply the quantum constant times the dimensionality increase, which in this case is significant, because you at least double the dimensionality. And you get a very big jump in the amount that energy follows by. Even the slightest thought can cause almost anything to be created in the astral world. In the etheric world, you're barely able to change any part of the world around you other than to be able to fly around it and to move easily. You can't really change things. But in the astral, because it's only the quantum constant is only two times greater. But in the astral world, if you want to build the Taj Mahal, recreate it anyway, you can do so in maybe a minute or less. Now that's pretty good. There's a cost to doing it, though, because your senses will wear down and your creative imagination may become tired. So if you constantly are doing things like that over minutes to hours of time, you may become relatively low in sense and low in energy and feel very tired. So that's the trade-off because you're living through your thoughts and your feelings, and your senses. Now, in the lowest astral subworld, which is the seventh subworld, besides the part where evil people live mostly through their sexual center, the lowest center in the physical body and the astral body. The astral body is a body that resembles the physical body in people's imagination, so it looks like that. But in reality, it does not. In reality, it's kind of amorphous. It just has a lot of energy moving around it. But when people get to the astral world, they want to look the way they think they like to be looked at or to appear. And so that instantly takes the shape then of the form that they've had all along. And around that form, there is an amorphous body that is several feet out from it that can be easily seen. It has all kinds of strange things moving in it called, well, I don't want to get to that yet, but there are parts of it that are very strange to us. And it looks a little weird because you can see the form of a person and then it looks like they have this funny cloud-like body around them, oftentimes kind of bigger at the bottom and a little narrower at the top. It's very, very strange that people have such kinds of things going on in them. And there's a lot of activity inside those clouds around the body, the physical, what looks like the old physical body. Now, people don't necessarily look the same when they go to the astral world because they desire to look different, maybe improve their appearance, maybe look younger, maybe change it in some way because they want to change it. They can appear whatever way they want to anyone who has as much or less sense than they do. However, to people who have considerably more sense than they have, they appear not as they desire, but they appear as the body is being changed by their either love or selfishness. If they're very loving and giving, then they appear in a more, we'll say, positive way, more beautiful, more possibly younger to some extent. But if they are very self-focused, they might appear quite ugly, even though to themselves they appear fine. And to people who aren't much more conscious than they are, they appear fine. But to the much more conscious people, they don't appear so fine. So people can look very different, again, based upon the light energy that's striking their body and how that light affects the bodies and senses of others. Because if the light moves in a way which is fantasy, I'll call it fantasy, and has connected to it certain fixed desires called glamours, then that light is bent and strange. And to people who have similar glamours, you may appear the way you want to appear to them. But to people who don't have those kind of glamours or fixed desires in their body, they see you truly as you are, which might be not all that pleasant. Now, isn't that a weird place? So you can literally look differently to different people at the same time. How do you like that? Okay, so what else is strange about it? Well, if you're in the seventh subworld, you're living through one sense. Your life expectancy is lower because you're using that sense up more quickly, and the energy around you is the densest of the astral energy except that found in the eighth sphere. So it takes more of a sense to operate correctly in the seventh subworld, and a person may lose their senses more quickly, and it causes them to, unfortunately, have some bad experiences. Some of those experiences can be only temporary for someone who is traveling, which is good news. But even in a temporary way, a few hours in the seventh subworld with some of the really nasty kooks that live in this world, these are really criminal, selfish, terribly miserable people, can be a very, very harried and destructive, painful, torturous experience for some people. If you go there and you want to have a sex fest with somebody, and that's all you have in mind, you might say, well, it was a pretty good experience. Except when you get back, your sexual feelings are going to be diminished, and you're going to want to have more physically brutal sex to even experience anything in comparison to what you may have had before you left, because your senses will be somewhat destroyed. So what I'm trying to explain to you is that astral travel to someplace like the seventh subworld is not a picnic. It often ends in a nightmare. That is a living nightmare. And while you're there, there's no difference between being there or here as far as reality. People say, well, isn't it just like having a dream and when you wake up it's no big deal? Nope. It isn't like just like having a dream. It's just like being here. The only difference is there, things happen much more intensely in an emotional sense. If you're self-focused, you're going to have some really heavy-duty self-focused emotional experiences, much deeper in terms of scarring and troublesome in terms of the effects on your astral body than if you're in the physical world. So you could have more traumatic experiences in a shorter period of time in the astral world. And let's talk about time. Time is dilated. What does that mean? You live in six times more time in the seven subworld than you do while you're physically alive, or why people are physically here. Therefore, 1 minute here is 6 minutes there. 1 hour here is 6 hours there. 2 hours here, 12 hours there, etc. Well, you could see that you don't have to be gone very long from here to have some unusual things happen there. And the inhabitants there are not very friendly or kind to people who, well, to anybody, but especially to people who are astral traveling, because they see them as targets and victims for their own use. How do they use you? Well, they want to use your senses and your creative imagination, because that's the only thing that counts. There's no money, not really. You can imagine you have money and you can produce it, but it's of no value. What is of value is sense and thought, creative imagination. That's all that really people want. It'll get you to use your creative imagination and thought to their advantage for some benefit that they're enjoying. It might be for your benefit, too, in some sense. But they're doing it for their own purposes. Sound like a good place to be? Well, remember, the people that are there were some of the most selfish people in the physical world before they died. That's the reason they went there. So it's no panacea by any stretch. And some people that go to the astral world think that because they're on the other side, everybody around them is going to be good to them and be wonderful, etc. Those people there know that, and they'll play on that to get what they want. Flyer beware. Okay, so what happens to people who actually live there? Well, they live there for a couple hundred or more years. But the point is that in the dozens of years, in tens of years, 30, 40, 50 years, their senses are pretty much diminished, and their creative imagination is all but gone. And these glamours, these things that are fixed desires inside them, have just about taken over their life. And they become victims to all those around them that are younger and stronger. And it's a terrible experience for another 100 to 150 years for these folks. Pretty bad news. Now you can call it hell, but there really is not a hell. There really isn't. It's the experience in a person learning to become more loving and to not be at that level of extreme selfishness emotionally in the future. That's what it's about. Now, you could say, well, I want to go to the seventh subworld to actually see those people so I can sociologically study them. Well, I went through that. And let me tell you the danger about that. The danger about that is that the studying them is a glamour. It's the fixed desire to have knowledge so that you can use it in some way in your return. And they can easily turn that around on you, believe me. The only way you can go there in any safe way is if you're truly there, it's a matter of service for those who desire and have a need for some help from someone of greater consciousness than themselves. Those very few people who can go there and do that from this world are rare. And for the most part, most people that go there are just lost very quickly in their own desires. And they just have a bad trip. I'm not saying don't do it positively. I'm just giving you the warnings, the cautions. And you don't have to have an astral experience at all to get over your fear of death, because just the etheric is not so terrible, potentially, and much easier to do, by the way. Astral travel can take a year or years to accomplish in terms of the meditative necessities involved. because you literally have to go through the sexual center to get there. You feel yourself shrinking down and moving in the sexual center, and a lot of people freak out from that sense. Then once you get through that, you got to stay focused on the creative imagination that started the whole process, and keep your consciousness on the feeling that you had connected to that imagination while you go through the tunnel of light. So the difficulty in getting there is quite high. You could theoretically travel in a matter of months. It may be years, if ever, for some people, to astrally travel, but it's possible. I don't want to say it's not, because I've met a lot of people who've done it, so it's not like, well, gee, nobody really can do that. No, you can do it, but I don't know if you want to. Okay, so what about the next place you could astrally travel to? Well, you can go to the sixth subworld, and that's a little bit better. I mean, you're going to go through your solar plexus chakra, and the people there are not quite as selfish. They have a different kind of selfishness. The people in the seventh subworld want to replicate the physical world as closely as they can and get all the things they didn't get while they were physically alive. Okay? That's what the basis of life is in the seventh subworld. But in the sixth subworld, people don't care about the physical world so much. They really care about how they feel. They just want to feel certain ways that they didn't get enough of, or didn't get any of, possibly, while they were physically alive. They want to be in a certain state of feeling. Whatever their thoughts are revolves around creating that state of feeling for themselves. But it doesn't necessarily mean changing their physical world to replicate exactly what they wanted while they were physically alive, like a certain car or a certain kind of house. That may not matter to them. They may have very little concern about the physical surroundings, but just to get to the very feelings they have. Objects become a method or a means of gaining a certain feeling rather than a possessing or having. So they have a different mode of operation component. It's a frenetic place because people's feelings change so rapidly, and what they want is the sense of feeling continuously and often to change, because it becomes tiresome to have the same feeling for very long, especially when you want it to be as intense as possible, which is what they want. As you increase the intensity, the time that you get that you have before it becomes overwhelmingly boring is a very short time. So it's a frenetic and kind of meaningless kind of people doing things for certain feelings that exist within themselves, but then changing them fairly rapidly. And when they change, they may disappear from your perspective, because as soon as they change what feeling they're in, they're no longer in the same location you are, even though you may be have been sharing the same exact location before. Once they change the direction of their feeling, they're gone. They just disappear. Go somewhere else, where others are like they are feeling. If you can't keep up with their feelings, then you can't keep up with them. So the relationship issue, while relatively or semi-permanent in the seventh subworld, is the exact opposite in the sixth. People have these fleeting relationships with each other, and they come and go. Well, they may see each other again at some point when their feelings match, but it's a goofy place. You can't really have any kind of long-term relationship with somebody, because unless you're willing to change your feelings with their feelings, you can't keep up with them. Now, some people do that, but it doesn't last very long when they do, even if they have a close kind of relationship. They're fragile at best. People that go to the sixth astral subworld can be abused like the people do in the seventh. But they're abused in a way that, again, keeps them moving more and will use up their senses sometimes even faster because of the frenetic nature. People live longer in the sixth astral subworld, but their senses can diminish almost as quickly as in the sixth astral subworld. It can diminish as fast as those in the seventh, because people in the sixth have this propensity for going to extremes on intensity of energies. Two subworlds are just everyone are very nice to visit. And again, people are going to be looking for fresh blood, new meat. When you get there, you have pristine senses, but no guards up, and you don't know what you're dealing with. They'll take full advantage of it in every way possible. Get you to use all of your energies, all of your creative imagination, and they get to use as little as possible. Now, you can reach in a kind of an agreement with the individual and share some exchange of energies. They actually have clubs and places that people go where they do that sort of thing. But there's still the possibility, even when you're doing that, someone else could come in and try to intervene and take something from both of you, even though you're sharing among each other. It's a terrible place. Terrible place. It's just as bad or worse than the seventh sub-world. And it has, unfortunately, no safeguards. I mean, you can't go to, like, the police or somebody like that. No such thing. They don't have any social protections. No means of really getting around the problems that such instant gratifications take place. There's nothing that you can do to stop it unless you have higher consciousness. And then you'd only be doing it to stop if you're much higher consciousness and you're trying to protect someone. All right, so I hope that that experience is going to be one of yours if you decide to go astral traveling. Then there's the fifth subworld. The fifth subworld is kind of like physical Earth, a little lower in consciousness on the average than some parts of the planet. There's no place exactly like physical Earth because there's jumps in consciousness when you die, and so people don't stay the same. But the fifth subworld is a place where people live by rules and laws. And I guess if you're a socialist, there's a good chance you're going to end up in the fifth subworld. No matter what your intentions were in terms of, quote-unquote, wanting to help people, if you really believe that rules and taking people's freedoms away by collective action is a good thing, you'll end up in the fifth subworld. The fifth subworld is composed of people wanting to protect themselves from what they have can see from their vantage point happening in the sixth and seventh subworlds, and they don't want to live in that. They don't want to live in that crazy, chaotic disorder. So they settle on a kind of socialistic process, a collective kind of consciousness to protect themselves in most places. Some places don't have it. Those places have people who want to be free, but only for their own purposes, and they don't care if everybody else is being controlled by the collective consciousness of others. As long as they're free, they're okay with that. That's that real freedom. But that's what they think. And going to the fifth subworld requires moving through the Ajna Center singly. And every time you move through a single center, by the way, and you go to the astral world, you're damaged in that center. The only way to go to any of the astral subworlds without damaging a center is to use at least three centers together and then balance the energy between the three centers, and you won't damage the centers to any amount just to get there. How much they get damaged once you're there, that's another process entirely, a totally different one from the one of getting it. But to get through these three centers together is no easy chore, because it's hard enough to go through one center. And most people don't like initially the feeling of their consciousness moving through a center. They feel like they're literally being squeezed down and then pushed out from a center. Imagine going through three centers at one time. That's quite an experience. And by the way, it is something you can get used to, but initially quite hard to do. If you want to learn a little bit more about that, you can again read either Chapter 8 in Life's Hidden Meaning. The textbook explains what you have to do, or you can read Afterlife Love, and one of the characters actually goes through this, but not easily. And a great cost in his life, so not an easy process at all to go through. All right, going to the fifth subworld is really probably the first part of sanity. The sixth and seventh, there's no sanity. And I can tell you, in my own experiences, the first few months, all my experiences were to the sixth and seventh subworlds. I really thought that life after death was crazy and not worth even having. At that time, I actually got despondent and had great doubts about what God, if God existed or if anything existed. It wasn't until I got to the fifth that I realized that, hey, there is a method to this badness, and this isn't as crazy as I thought. And I began to see that people were really fulfilling their own desires, and it wasn't based upon some kind of punitive thing. It wasn't because there was a mechanical system with no God. It wasn't because of any of the things I had previously believed, but rather it's our way of working out our own astral or emotional selfishness. This is how we're going back to our soul. And so astral traveling to these places is kind of a lesson, you might say, in all of the problems that people have in trying to get back to being a soul and to work out the issues of their own selfishness while they were doing it. The fifth astral subworld, people are a little more selfish on an average. You may not notice this than they are, say, in most of the first world countries in the world. There are people from all over the world in the fifth subworld, but the average is a little more selfish than where I'm familiar with, which is the United States, and probably than a lot of other countries. But maybe not so much depending upon how and where people live. I mean, in very in dictatorial countries where people are terribly repressed and suppressed and they're living in certain circumstances, those people may not be able to develop their consciousness very high because they're being constantly attacked by the government and the tyranny and having a lack of freedom. All that destroys a good deal of the love that people have. And there's some parts of the fifth subworld that are composed of groups of people that come from those areas. And they have sometimes real problems. In general, the biggest problem is that people want to control you when you're there because they don't want your emotionality to be any way different from them. So while on the sixth subworld, people are just randomly doing anything they want and creating chaos, the fifth subworld, the almost exact opposite is taking place because they can see that. They don't want to experience it. So they come up with their own ideas, their own ways of collectively preventing it. Groups of them get together and will control individuals or even smaller groups to do what they want. Oh, it's a wonderful system. A lot of people think it's good for them to be that way. And they try to have creative, imaginative solutions for almost all ways of living. Even the people who live freely still have their own creative imaginations of what it means to be free. So, like, if you ain't like us, then you're not good enough for anybody and get out of here. So no one's really free. Not really. Well, you know, we're running out of time. I almost need to say that we'll probably have to finish this next week, so I'm going to make this into a two-part show because there's a lot more to talk about astral travel than just tell you about the astral world. There's a lot more to tell you about what it means to have out-of-body experiences, and also I wanted to talk about what happens when you actually die in comparison to having an out-of-body experience. We haven't had time to go over any of those things tonight, so we will go into them next week, and I guess we know what the topic is going to be. It's going to be part two of the physics and metaphysics of out-of-body travel. And until next week, this has been Niles McFlower for Why Life Is.